Hello, my name is Roger Bingham. I'm a colleague of Terry Sanowski's at the Salk and also working with him on this enterprise called the Science Network, which you noticed as you came in is filming these proceedings. I was going to tell you a little bit about the Science Network because we're so behind on time. I think I'll just move very quickly along and tell you that it's an attempt to do a kind of a C-SPAN for science, that there is a website at www.thesciencenetwork.org, which sets out some of the programming that we'll be attempting to do, and we're glad that we were able to help the American Friends of Hebrew University, including Bill Isakoff and his colleagues, to ensure that this symposium has a life beyond this auditorium. Before we go to the panel, have any of you actually seen Einstein's brain, or even a piece of it? Some years ago when I was doing some programs about the addicted brain, the sexual brain, male-female differences, I had the great good fortune to go and work in the lab of Arnold Scheibel at UCLA, whose wife is Marion Diamond, a neuroanatomist at Berkeley. And she had got from the man who did the autopsy on Einstein a piece of Einstein's brain, one of a few labs that, in fact, have this. And this is a stain of what Einstein's brain looked like. And there have been some scientific papers written, and it turns out that in a particular area of Einstein's brain, the left inferior parietal cortex, which is sort of in that area, he seems to have had a larger number of glial cells, which are roughly support and nourishment for neurons, than most people. So the point about this is that this area of the brain has been associated with increased capacity to visualize and also do mathematical calculation. I think it's probably just another just-so story. The distance from the embryo to Einstein is considerable with many environmental influences, and it's by no means clear that whether this architecture produced Einstein or whether Einstein, with his imaginings, produced this kind of architecture. So I think we have, for Einstein's legacy, we probably have to leave the neuroscience at this point and go back to the safe harbor of physics. And could I invite the panelists to come up? Those who are left. Sol. We have an additional panelist, which is Professor Solomon Galam. Sol is the holder of the Andrew and Erna Viterbi Chair in Communications at the USC School of Engineering.
Is there anyone in the audience ever met Einstein?
And Sol is a twofer. He's an elected life member of the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering. And he's also a master mathematician and the inventor of innumerable games and puzzles, including polyominoes. I've just been asked by Bill Isakoff to ask you if anybody in the audience ever met Einstein. I'm not sure what his motive was, but I think I'm about to find out. Ah, Sol met Einstein. All right. Let me go to a point that David Gross mentioned. He mentioned the problem with labels, the way in which phrases like relativity in Einstein's case or uncertainty in Heisenberg's case became sort of totemic and misunderstood and almost willfully misused by the general public. It was almost as if after Einstein and after Heisenberg, there was nothing, the center was gone, that we entered a postmodern universe. David, do you have any comment on that?
Well, I made my comment. Einstein, I think, regretted relativity, although it helped to make him a celebrity. He really was talking about invariance and symmetry and not relativism. The uncertainty principle is also, as you said, highly misused. So I don't know. Some of these things can never be addressed.
Right.
Memes get stuck in the public's imagination.
Let's pick up on your other point then about Platonism. I was talking to Sol about this a little earlier. There was a wonderful book out by a novelist and philosopher called Rebecca Goldstein at the moment, which is essentially a life of Kurt Gödel, and it has a lot of passages in there with Gödel and Einstein walking along and talking. And it's quite clear that Gödel, as a mathematician, was a Platonist, that he believed that there were truths of mathematics that were impervious to any human activity. You said that Einstein was a Platonist. Sol, do you want to comment on what kind of a mathematician Einstein was and what Platonism meant in this case?
Well, I think well over 90% of all mathematicians are Platonists about mathematics. That is, we believe that the theorems are already there. We merely discover them if we make enough effort. And when you get to physical reality, most of us think Plato was probably wrong, that a table is not merely an attempt to realize the ideal table somewhere in Never Never Land. But when you get to the most theoretical physicists, what they are doing is mathematics. They are constructing mathematical models that miraculously correspond to reality in a way that never ceases to amaze people. The physicist Sir Arthur Eddington commented that it is just incredibly remarkable how the universe seems to obey these mathematical laws. So it's not unusual that an Einstein or a Newton even was very Platonist about their type of physics. There's a famous quote from Newton. I'm sure he spent a lot of time crafting it, where he said, I know not how I appear to others, but for myself, I've been like a little boy playing by the seashore and finding a pebble that was smoother or shinier than another, while the great ocean of truth lay undiscovered before me. And I think Einstein had a similar view that the universe was out there, and the task was simply to discover the laws, not to invent them. There are many other physicists who take a different view. They think that subatomic particles don't exist until they invent them. But Einstein was clearly much more of a Platonist than that about physics.
We have a black hole question from the audience here. If our universe was created from a singularity during the Big Bang and matter is compacted to a singularity in a black hole, can black holes give, in quotes, birth to new universes? Who would like to approach that one? Ned?
Well, it's really a question that doesn't have a definite answer. I mean, the term singularity has got a very definite meaning. It means we don't know how to proceed through the singularity. And so, I mean, we have laws of physics. Singularity means the laws of physics have broken down. And so what happens at that time or afterwards is relatively unpredictable.
David?
There are similarities, indeed, between those two kinds of singularities. And indeed, there have been some speculations about exactly the point raised by the question. But I definitely agree with Ed that we don't know. And in fact, it's one of the main questions facing us, certainly in people who now think they have a quantum theory of gravity like string theory to try to find out what happens not only at the singularity inside a black hole that is hard to see unless you fall into it, but also the singularity that is the origin of the Big Bang. And although the laws of physics so far, even with the help of string theory, haven't been able to proceed back to the Big Bang in order to build theories of the observations that these people now observe, you have to go almost to the Big Bang. So we're going to have to deal with that problem pretty soon.
Well, you mentioned string theory. Here's another question from the audience. Is the string theory compatible with the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics and or Einstein's disbelief in the latter?
String theory is certainly compatible with quantum mechanics. Everything, to my knowledge, is compatible with quantum mechanics. Many people, in addition to Einstein, over the years have expressed many worries about quantum mechanics for different reasons. For example, coming back to black holes, one of the things that Zvi didn't have time to get into was the paradox that Stephen Hawking raised when he discovered that black holes aren't so black. They actually, in quantum mechanical theories, radiate thermal radiation. And it appeared for a while that you throw all sorts of stuff into a black hole, and the only thing that comes out is black body radiation with no dependence on what it is that you threw in, so you lost information. And Hawking famously said, not only does God throw dice, but he throws the dice where you can't see them. And information is lost forever in black holes. To many of us who came from, you know, the quantum mechanical particle physics point of view, this didn't seem right. And in fact, one of the great recent triumphs of string theory is to finally show, at least in some toy examples, which are very close to the kind of black holes we see in the universe, this does not happen. Black holes do not violate the laws of quantum mechanics, we are now convinced. So I don't see any threats to quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, however, is still a very new theory. It's only 70 years old, and you've seen already in the case of Brownian motion, it took 80 years before. And deep concepts in physics often take a long time to fully understand and appreciate.
Well, we have a question here which actually said, can you please discuss the phenomenon of Hawking radiation and the apparent evaporation of black holes? I'll take that as read, as sort of covered. I remember that Bohr always used to complain and chastise Einstein about the way in which he kept on giving instructions to God. And Jacob Bronowski, I remember, said that Einstein used to talk as if God were his uncle sometimes, and sometimes as if he were God's uncle. Plainly, this whole notion of the God and the old one is a very important part of the entire Einstein story. And you will recall, of course, that you can't deal with Einstein without looking at what he meant by that. And he always used to say that he believed in Spinoza's God, the philosopher Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists. This was a response that he sent to, it was New York's Rabbi Herbert Goldstein, who asked Einstein by telegram, "Do you believe in God? Stop. Answer paid. 50 words." And Einstein came back with these 25 words. Hanuch, would you like to elaborate on that? Have you thought about, you obviously have thought a lot about the relationship that Einstein has. And Gerald Holton has some talks in which the Spinoza reference is really about his passion to unify
Gerald
and seeing.
Holton, a noted historian of science, Harvard, actually the man who was called by Einstein's secretary to Princeton after his death to put some order in the mess of papers that he left behind. And it was Gerald Holton who turned them into an organized archives. He recently published a remarkable little article in Daedalus about Einstein's three paradises. One is, in Einstein's own words, the religious paradise of youth. But throughout his life, Einstein referred on many occasions to God and to a kind of religion which he invented for himself, just as he invented his own physics. He invented his own religion, to which he referred as a cosmic religion, which is devoid of an anthropomorphic God who cares about what we do or don't do. And it is in that sense that he related to Spinoza. Einstein was emotionally and intellectually very close to Baruch Spinoza. He not only accepted Spinoza's concept as of nature as God or God as nature, but he also identified with Spinoza's fate. Spinoza was excommunicated from his community for, among other things, for adopting, embracing causality. And you know, if you believe that everything is causal, then in the religious system, where comes your moral responsibility? Einstein considered himself sharing that fate, being almost excommunicated or estranged from his community for a similar reason, for not willing to give up causality. He wrote limericks about Spinoza. When his sister was ill at her bedside, he read Spinoza to her. So there is a great, you know, relationship between Einstein and Spinoza.
There was also a poem, I think, which is in the archives, gone Zu Spinoza's Ethik, which is a very sweet thing, which begins, "How I love that noble man more than I can say with words." So I was obviously... There's a question here for Terry. What is known about how the brain represents space and time? A short answer here, Terry. How does our neural representation of these quantities constrain our scientific intuitions in physics? Actually, a very good question.
Well, first of all, I have to preface my remarks by saying that we are at a stage in neuroscience which I would characterize as pre-Copernican. That is to say, we really don't know some of these very basic questions. I can tell you the molecules that the brain's made of, but I can't answer that question in a way that would satisfy you, because we don't have a real theory for how the brain works. We have models from some pieces, but we know roughly where space and time may be represented, and this comes from studying brain damage people who either through a brain stroke or a gunshot wound have lost the function of certain parts of the brain. And there's a phenomenon which is called neglect, which is just fascinating, and it occurs when you have damage to the parietal cortex, the very same part that Roger was talking about. And in these subjects, they will refuse to acknowledge the existence of the opposite side of their body. So if it's a lesion on the left parietal cortex, they will not acknowledge, in the sense that they'll just won't respond to anything in the right visual field. They won't be able to, for example, tell you anything about what's happening in the right arm and so forth. And it's as if they've lost the concept of the left side of the of the right side of the world. And it must be some imbalance between the way the brain represents the right and left side. So there's, from these fascinating experiments of nature, we have some tidbits. And I think the final story is just going to be absolutely amazing, because it's going to require a revolution as great as the ones that Einstein developed, I think, to go beyond our sort of classical psychological concepts that we have of memory and attention. And we need to replace that with something that is more closely related to the way that nature evolved behavior in the real world.
Okay, thank you. We have a question for Professor Piran. What would you predict the natural evolution of the black hole of our galaxy? Do black holes have a lifespan?
The black hole in our galaxy, in the center of our galaxy, is sort of in its last stages, or sort of dormant stages of its evolution. It's sort of past the exciting time, the exciting time where it was younger and it was capturing dust and gas from the rest of the galaxy. At that time, it was active. We had an active galactic nuclei, and the sun was there. There was a lot of emission of X-rays and other radiation. This is almost gone by now, simply because there is no supply of matter. So the black hole now in the center of our galaxy really depends on what the rest of the galaxy will do. If somehow the rest of the galaxy, because of evolution of the way it will evolve, will send more chunks of matter into the central region, then we'll see brightening and we will see some excitement there. Otherwise, it will just stay there and the star will swirl around it. It will swallow stars every once in a while, but nothing terribly exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, there will be something that happens on a cosmic timescale. In several billion years, our galaxy and the Andromeda Nebula will collide. And when that happens, we will disrupt the orderly pattern of orbits of stars, and a lot of matter will have a chance to fall into the black hole in the center of our galaxy. And so it will almost certainly once again be a very active galactic nucleus.
There is that old joke that's often told by astrophysicists when they're talking about when the end of things will be, and somebody says 6 billion years, and the man says 6 billion? God, I thought you said 6 million. Oof. The fate of the Hubble Space Telescope is being debated. If it is to be abandoned, what will be the effect on research such as Professor Wright and Professor Piran described? Ned?
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope was designed in an era when the space shuttle was supposed to fly once per week and cost $10 million per flight to fly. And that era has never existed. And so as a result, the Hubble Space Telescope, while it's a great instrument, has always been a very expensive instrument. And my point of view is that it's a nice car, a luxury telescope, luxury car that's 15 years old with 3 billion miles on it. And now it needs a new transmission, and it's going to cost $2 billion to install it. And the question is whether we should spend the money that way or build something like JDUM and the JWST, which is the what used to be called the Next Generation Space Telescope, that's actually a 6-meter telescope, a much larger telescope, and its whole construction cost is less than the cost of repairing the Hubble.
Go ahead, Zvi.
Yeah, I will sort of share my opinion. The Hubble Space Telescope really far exceeded what was expected from it. I remember when I was much younger, and we were all waiting for the Hubble Space Telescope. And at that time, there was another Hubble constant, which is the 2 years that Hubble was supposed to be sent 2 years from now. And this was like this for almost 15 years. Now it was finally launched, and far exceeded all previous expectations. But I think that spending all funds to repair it now will be put so much burden on all other NASA scientific programs that it's time to say goodbye.
One of the scientific advisory board members of the Science Network is a Nobel laureate called Sir Harold Kroto, who is one of the discoverers of the structure of C60, carbon-60. Which he was instrumental in naming Buckminster Fullerene because of its curious soccer ball shape. And Harry in England is also a great communicator of science. He got the Faraday Medal of the Royal Society for Communication of Science. And in his lecture, he began, in fact, with some pictures of the old Einstein, the one that looks like Walter Matthau or Albert Schweitzer, and said, you know, this man is an imposter. Then you go to the nice picture of Einstein at the age of 26, looking more, as Timothy Ferris put it, looking more like Bob Dylan with smoldering eyes and so on. And you realize that the work was done by this young man. And I think it's wonderful that this institution today has actually commemorated this particular year, the 1905 year. I think we are running tight on time, so I perhaps should end with a little reminder from David Gross's Nobel Banquet speech, where he said at the end, "I'm happy to report that there is no evidence that we're running out of our most important resource, ignorance." How lucky for science, how lucky for scientists, and how lucky for the Nobel Foundation, and how lucky for this institution as well. So we adjourn to lunch and hear Dr. Varmus.
Owen, thank you very much. I suspect the last thing this audience wants to hear at this point is yet another talk, but I don't mind the clatter, and please have your dessert. I've had a little bit of it. It's very good. Now, your organizers have the organizers of this 100th anniversary of Einstein's miraculous year have asked me to describe the impact of his field, physics, on the fields that I know something about, biology and medicine. Now, they've done me this honor not to recognize any knowledge I might have retained from college courses in physics, but to allow me to discuss one of my enduring convictions about medical research, namely that we can wage an effective war against disease only if we harness the energy of many disciplines, not just biology and medicine. Now, this may seem like a simple message, but it's actually a very important message at a time when I hear too often profundity assigned to the simple idea that physics was the science of the 20th century and biology is the science of the 21st century. It's an important message at a time when the NIH budget has doubled to over $27 billion in less than a decade, while the budgets for physical sciences have barely budged, and in the case of some agencies are currently being cut. Now, I'm well aware that of the dangers that our nation's current fiscal policies pose for the support and the vitality of all sciences, including biology and medicine, but that's a troubling story for another day. Now, the disciplines that are allied with biology and medicine are legion, and they range from math and engineering and computer sciences to sociology, anthropology, and behavioral sciences. But the weight of historical evidence and the prospects for the future place physics and perhaps chemistry most prominently among them. And today I'm going to consider as swiftly and briefly as humanly possible the effects of physics on the medical sciences, and I'm going to do that from roughly four perspectives. So first I'd like to tell you something about how physics has informed medicine by approaching the human body not just as a spiritual entity with full of hypotheses and novel ideas, but as a physical entity that can be explored with physical techniques. Then I'm going to tell you a little bit about how and why physicists became biologists and why that was so important in the growth of our current understanding of biological systems. Then I will tell you a little bit about how biology challenges physicists now. And in order to earn my airfare home, I'm going to say a few words about Einstein and in the connection of explaining to you how physicists are contributing to biology with, in at least one prominent case, and perhaps others as time permits, the ideas that are at least introduced and in the papers from 1905. And I will try to entertain you a bit with some personal anecdotes along the way. Now, many people before me have made the really very obvious point that for at least several hundred years, physicists, especially their methods and machines, have been illuminating, magnifying, measuring the properties of the human body and virtually every other living thing. And one can go back to the writings of von Leeuwenhoek and Hooke and many others to see the truth of this. But this notion was brought home to me very early in my own life when my father, who was a general practitioner whose office was in a reconstructed porch right next to our dining room, showed me how X-rays worked and how fluorography could reveal the bones and lungs of our pets and sometimes his patients, and as well as making the diagnoses of disease. A couple of slides show you some earlier examples of the domestic application of these methods. This, for example, is the famous photograph of Rankin's X-ray of his own wife's hand with her ring, which was made only 5 years before he won the first Nobel Prize in Physics in 1901. And this is a picture of a doctor working in his offices in 1896, showing with the method of fluorography that that Edison also used, the lungs of a female patient, possibly his wife. The significance of using the discoveries of physics to perceive biological function was further impressed on me at college when one of my first independent projects required that I try to explain the repeating peaks and valleys shown on your left that appear in an electrocardiogram, my own. This is a simulated vision of what I might have looked like as a college student, having my electrocardiogram taken, and the term paper, whoever, doesn't appear on this slide for good reason. Further lessons occurred to me at medical school when faculty like David Rittenberg were famed for having used radioisotopes, obviously a discovery of important physicists, Marie Curie and others, to measure the lifetime of red blood cells circulating in human blood and other cell types. And by tagging those cells with isotopes that decayed, it was possible for him to follow the half-lives of these important biological entities. Now, these few personal memories are only a sampling of the hundreds of physics-based methods that have been applied to view and to understand living bodies without the disruption of anatomical dissection or to visualize very small components of living things. Now, there was a more systematic rendering of this kind of approach carried out by a Stanford professor, Robert Hofstadter, in 1983, and you probably can't read the list on the left, and that's just as well, because it's a rather tedious and in some cases tendentious list of physical methods and approaches and their corollary in medicine. So at the top of the list is mechanics and orthopedics versus dynamics and heart motion, down to spectroscopy and as opposed to NMR and in medicine, obviously x-rays and radiology and so forth. But it does impress on you the ubiquity of physical methods and physical thinking in the development of modern medicine. Now, these methods have been refined dramatically in recent years, and the methods of macro imaging in particular, of seeing whole organs in bodies, has been refined to the point where it's now possible to use these methods to look at many of our organs, not only from a structural point of view, but from a functional point of view. And here's a picture from an article in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago showing how PET scanning can be used to reveal the human brain at work, showing patterns of illumination early in the thought process and late in the thought process. Here's pictures taken by Bob Balaban at the NIH showing how magnetic resonance imaging can be used to examine heart at work and to reveal regions of the heart muscle that have been damaged by a myocardial infarction, how that affects flow. This is a picture taken from a recent presentation in my own institution, Memorial Sloan Kettering, where Hedy Hritschak and Steve Solomon are attempting to use a combination of computerized tomography and positron emission scanning to examine cancer cells by taking advantage of the high metabolic activity of those cells and the ability of CT scanning to show the anatomical location of a cancerous lesion to give you both anatomy and metabolism in the analysis of cancerous lesions. Similarly, at a micro level, at a level below the naked eye, at looking at the much smaller entities in the body, such as chromosomes, it's possible to make use of principles of optics and chemistry and computational analysis of signals from chromophobes to look at DNA from individual chromosomes, giving a very beautiful systematic picture of the human karyotype on the upper part of this panel, where a set of normal human chromosomes are aligned, but also to show the bizarre juxtapositions of pieces of DNA from different chromosomes in the kinds of abnormal chromosomes that are commonly encountered in human cancers. And in many cases, these juxtapositions give rise to the kinds of abnormalities that Owen, for example, has been famous for analyzing as making contributions to the development of leukemias and other cancers. So these methods, based on physical practices, have a daily representation in the life of modern medicine. A time-honored technique, X-ray crystallography, has given us remarkably detailed views of biological molecules that were only a few years ago thought very difficult to envision. For example, molecules that serve as entry points for ions into cells, molecules that are embedded in membranes and therefore inherently difficult to examine. This shows one dramatic example of the ability of physically trained individuals. This happens to be an MD who learned the principles of physics later on, Rodman McKinnon, who took on this very difficult problem of looking at membrane proteins with X-ray crystallography and was able to solve the problem of how potassium passes through membranes in a selective and efficient way. And this kind of work, for which he received the Nobel Prize a few years ago, now informs the study of many important diseases, including epilepsy, arrhythmias, deafness, and others. And indeed, this physical advance for which he was awarded the prize in chemistry was important enough to us as biologists and medical scientists for me to use this in 1999 to justify further investments in research to our congressional appropriations subcommittees. Now, despite the centrality of the kinds of physical contributions that I've made, that I've described for you to modern biology, a serious physicist might interpret my emphasis as limited and perhaps even insulting, because I may have seemed to have portrayed physicists as merely the developers of tools and measurements that allow biomedical scientists to do the really important work. Now, there are reasons for me to be sensitive about this. For example, in a 1967 commentary on the role of physics in biology and medicine, a fellow named Sergei Feidelberg, a physicist from Mount Sinai Hospital, for whom I could not find an image in my Google search, noted that while such spectacular developments created a clear and unequivocal need for physicists and their help, the role of the physicist was that of a glorified technician, engaged in methodology and instrumentation, dignified only by the strangeness of his doings and the mysteriousness of his tools. Now, I, for one, especially in this company, would not accept this that interpretation. And on the contrary, physics-based development has resulted in progress in virtually every aspect of biomedical sciences, and the technology has been developed in concert with new ideas in physics. Moreover, an expanded investment in physics would doubtless allow the invention of new and better technology for many of the things that biomedical scientists are struggling to do, and I'll come back to some of those in a couple of moments. Now, I'd like at this point to turn to the second question that I advertised at the outset, namely, how and why did physicists become biologists, and how do they transform our understanding of major biological principles, not the least of which is the understanding of heredity. Now, over 50 years ago, in a speech that was delivered to the 1,000th meeting of the Connecticut Academy of Arts and Sciences, Max Delbruck, who is shown here, and I gather is the best, was the best friend of someone who's in the audience today, Max Delbruck, who was a leading physicist who had made his own personal conversion to biology some years earlier, attempted to describe that transition from physics to biology. And he said, and I quote, "A mature physicist acquainting himself for the first time with the problems of biology is puzzled by the circumstance that there are no absolute phenomena. The animal or plant or microorganism he is working with or she is working with, is but a link in an evolutionary chain of changing forms, none of which has any permanent validity. Even the molecular species and the chemical reactions which he encounters are the fashions of today, to be replaced by others as evolution goes on. The organism he or she, with the deference to Larry Summers, is working on with is not a particular expression of an ideal organism, but one thread in an infinite web of all living forms, all interrelated and all interdependent. The physicist has been reared in a different atmosphere, and you've heard some of that atmosphere described today." So Delbruck went on to say, "The materials and the phenomena he works with are the same here and now as they were at all times, and as they are on the most distant star." Now, Delbruck, shown here, was a student of Niels Bohr, and I don't know why, on impulse, I inserted this postage stamp, but I thought it was sort of a nice juxtaposition of Bohr with Einstein. Introduce a little bit of Albert in this talk, but Bohr was for a time a successful physicist, but he's best remembered as a powerful proselytizer among physicists for biology and as a designer of biological experiments of unusual beauty. And with the assistance of a book by Bohr called Light and Life, and a perhaps more famous book, a small book called What is Life, by another famous physicist, Erwin Schrödinger, he attracted many other physicists to biology. The effects of his missionary zeal were powerful, not just because some very smart people started to do biology, because they brought to biological problems, problems that had in the past been approached largely in a descriptive, observational way, a quantitative, analytic approach, an approach that created the atmosphere in which the principles of molecular biology were discovered by seeking the physical basis of heredity. Now, an instructive example of Delbruck's proselytizing was described by Jonathan Weiner in a charming article about Seymour Benzer, another physicist that I'm not going to be able to talk about in great detail. I'll show a picture of him in a moment. But one of his other leading physicists was a guy named Leo Szilard, who is shown on the left in this old photograph, which was taken. I think some of you who've been to Cold Spring Harbor will recognize this road leading up the hill away from the Cold Spring Harbor waterfront, and standing next to Hershey, also a Nobel Prize-winning biologist. But what Szilard said was that physicists brought to biology not any skills acquired in physics in particular, although I would dispute that, but rather an attitude, the conviction which few biologists had at that time, that mysteries can be solved. Now, Delbruck and his friends, such as Szilard, were gripped by some fundamental mysteries. What is the physical form in which hereditary information that we know must exist, must be transmitted from parents to children, is actually stored? How is it reproduced when the cell divides? Even more impressively, when a single virus particle invades a cell and makes hundreds of thousands of copies of itself. How is that information reassorted during sexual reproduction? How does the information change when mutations occur? So answers to many of these questions came from the so-called phage school, a school that he founded, composed of a group of former physicists and a few biologists, such as Salvo Luria, who was trained as a physician. Salvo's shown at the microscope with Delbruck hovering above him. And they shared the passion that Delbruck expressed for reducing the problems of heredity to simple rules, to the existence of physical entities, and attempted to study the conservation of information by studying the replication and genetic behavior of bacterial viruses, which are also called bacteriophage or phage when they infect their bacterial hosts. Now, the studies culminated in the findings that form the pillars of modern molecular biology, the identification of DNA as genetic material, description of the physical organization of DNA through X-ray crystallography, and here some of the pillars of those discoveries are shown. Rosalind Franklin, her beautiful picture of the B form of DNA, Maurice Wilkins, Watson and Crick, the double helix drawn by Odile, Francis's wife. From these studies also came the understanding of how DNA could encompass genetic information, how that information could be replicated, how it could be expressed. It led to some direct thinking that I believe had its groundings in the way physicists thought about how a code could be generated for DNA. And people like Francis Crick and George Gamow gave serious thought to the possibilities that then led to the experiments by Nuremberg and Ochoa and others that actually defined the genetic code. Now, Delbruck and his phage school were important, but there were, in fact, multiple intellectual lineages, all in one way or another connected with physics, that helped create the modern world of molecular biology that we, Owen, I, and many others inhabit today. For example, Warren Weaver was a mathematical physicist who became a scientist administrator at the Rockefeller Foundation and other places, who in 1932 first used the term molecular biology. And he chose this phrase because he foresaw that the moment would arrive when the distinction between chemistry and physics and even mathematics on the one hand and biology and medicine on the other would be so illusory and in fact so unfortunate they didn't want the word biology to describe the programs he was supporting at the Rockefeller Foundation. British scientists with a strong physical bent, like Asbury and William Lawrence Bragg and others, use X-ray diffraction to study the organization of fibers of many kinds, often just proteins involved in production of textiles. But that was an intellectual lineage that then led to Wilkins and Franklin and, of course, Watson and Crick and DNA. The American geneticists Morgan and Mueller and Seymour Benzer all had physical backgrounds, used physical agents such as X-rays to induce mutations, and that led to an understanding of many of the physical and even psychic behaviors of fruit flies. Mueller's affinity for the principles of physics was especially strong. He was fond of noting the potential similarities of mutations of genes to transmutation of elements, calling the prospect of understanding these events in physical terms the two keystones of our rainbow bridges to power. Well, a little beyond the metaphorical hyperbole, perhaps, but nevertheless an important idea. Now, let me say a few things about the present and future and where physics will play a role, and allude briefly to a role played by ideas that Einstein developed in 1905. Now, during the birth of modern molecular genetics, physicists contributed their analytic skills, but they were not really doing physics, and many were not even using the computational or imaging tools of physics as many biologists now do. You saw, for example, that picture of Lurie and Delbruck working at the microscope, and they were just laboriously counting virus infections by hand and eye, like any other biologist. But contemporary biology, especially the deciphering of genomes by nucleotide sequencing, has begun to change all that. You're all aware that the human genome and the genome of many other organisms, indeed, if one counts bacteria, hundreds of organisms, perhaps thousands, have now been elucidated at the nucleotide level. And it has become possible to study the expression, the structure of virtually all of these genes simultaneously by using physical and chemical methods to study by a variety of methods, two of which are illustrated here, how the complete consortium of genes in any single organism or individual, including humans, at one time on what are called gene chips. So the accumulation of information at an incredibly rapid pace, unprecedented in the history of biology, is creating biology as a science that demands much more intense mathematical and physical analysis than biologists have been accustomed to. And this analysis is going to be required to understand the workings of cells. Now, this change was actually foreshadowed in the lecture I referred to earlier, given by Delbruck in 1949. When he first described his awe at the complexity of biology, even though the tools weren't available at that time to try to sort out the components of that complexity. And he said, "The closer one looks at the performance of matter and living organisms, the more impressive the show becomes. The meanest living cell becomes a magic puzzle box full of elaborate and changing molecules, and far outstrips all chemical laboratories of man in the skill of organic synthesis." So he sounded a warning. "Biology is a very interesting field," he said, "because of the vastness of its structure and the extraordinary variety of strange facts. But to the physicist, it's also a depressing subject, because the analysis seems to have stalled around in a semi-descriptive manner without noticeably progressing toward a radical physical explanation. We are not yet at the point where we are presented with clear paradoxes, and this will not happen until the analysis of the behavior of living cells has been carried out in far greater detail." Well, it's clear that we now are at the point where we can begin to approach this radical analysis, and we can begin to put together circuitry of a kind here, shown in metaphorical form as a kind of a transistor box with just a small smattering of the 20 or 25,000 genes we know about displayed in the form of proteins made by those genes that are the components of the cell circuits that control the development of an organism, including a brain, as you heard earlier, from a single cell, the components of cell circuits that also go awry in cancer and many other diseases. So we're much closer to a radical physical explanation of the kind that Delbruck sought, because we do now have the genes, the RNAs, the proteins, and some of their basic functions are coming into view and beginning to put together networks of this kind. But it's going to be essential for us to begin to to use the principles of physics, engineering, mathematics, and computational sciences to put this picture together in a reasonable way. So, I've gotten this far with hardly mentioning the important name. What about Einstein, and where can I put him into some of this picture? Well, I want to focus briefly on one facet of 1905, the March paper, in which, as John Rigdon describes in his elegant little book that just came out this year that analyzes all five of the major writings of 1905, Rigdon said, one century after Einstein made the audacious suggestion that light is a particle, the photon plays many roles in physics. And today, Einstein's light particle is indispensable. But I'm going to argue that the photon is also indispensable in biology and medicine, and it's indispensable because it serves as a basic ingredient in the laser. Now, I don't think I would need to introduce the laser as an idea to most of you. You're all familiar with it just by driving up and down the boulevards in L.A., where many things are advertised in the night sky by laser projections. But it's important to remember that the laser came to be only because of an appreciation of light as something that can be envisioned and work with as a particle, as a component of quantum theory, and not simply as an electromagnetic wave. And as Charles Townes wrote in his autobiography a few years ago, Einstein was the first to recognize that if photons can be absorbed by atoms and lift them to a higher energy state, then light can also force an atom to give up its energy. One photon hits the atom, and two come out. The result is called simulated emission and results in coherent amplification, the code words for masers and lasers. And we now know that the laser itself, as a tool that is grounded in theoretical changes in our changes in our understanding of physical theory, has applications in many areas of important biological study that I'm going to just illustrate for you incredibly briefly, so we can go on to the music and to the Einstein tour and the rest of your activities for the day. And just to briefly show you how the laser can be used in detecting results on those gene chips I mentioned, how we can use lasers to work with single molecules, a process that eliminates the difficulty of trying to synchronize many molecules to learn about the behavior of a class of molecules, and how lasers can be used in medical treatment. So this is a simple picture of how chips are most commonly analyzed by shining laser light on a gene chip, and when the probe in these chips, a labeled DNA molecule, fails to hybridize, no light is generated, but it is made visible when the hybridizations occurred, showing these green spots. Lasers can be used and have been used importantly in studying many single molecule interactions. Perhaps the most famous is one that resulted from a collaboration between a famous physicist, Steve Chu from Stanford, who won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 97, and his colleague Jim Spudich, a well-known cell biologist, who put together Chu's so-called optical tweezers, laser-based method for holding one molecule in place to look at the force generated by a myosin fiber, a component of muscle, when myosin interacts with actin to generate a quantitative analysis of how myosin and actin interact to generate the force that's found in muscle movement. Lasers are used commonly in treatment, and in my own institution, we're using lasers as a means to raise the temperature and ablate tumors in sites that are remote from the surgeon's knife, such as in the brain, and that can be monitored by simultaneous use of magnetic resonance imaging to ensure that the thermal treatment with lasers actually leads to complete ablation. The final example I will give you is one that affects my own life. Like many extremely nearsighted people who run at the advanced age of over 50, shall we say, I noted some flashing lights one day and reported to my ophthalmologist, who said, you have an early tear in your retina. And within a few hours, I was sitting in front of a laser beam having a small tear. This is actually not mine. If any of you are interested in the rules that govern the privacy of medical information. This is some anonymous person's retina, but on the left you see a little tear of the kind that I had, and on the right you see it's been tacked down to prevent further damage to my retina by the use of this wonderful technique that is based on fundamental ideas advanced by Einstein in 1905. So, with that personal anecdote of appreciation of the great works of Einstein of 1905, let me just conclude by saying what has been my simple message, namely that physics, and Einstein in some cases, have been historically and still remain essential in the progress of medicine and biology. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.